gold, the Bitcoin hold.com. The Bitcoin self-custody is the whole. Find the strength inside your soul. Your soul. Oh, the Bitcoin hold.com.
So usually when we talk about physical security, there's this expectation of a very clear, you know, boundary.
Like, right.
You build a house, you put a solid deadbolt on the front door, lock it at night, and you sleep soundly knowing the threat is basically on the outside.
Yeah, it's a visible perimeter defense.
Exactly. It's comforting. But step into the realm of Bitcoin self-custody and suddenly that deadbolt just isn't enough.
Not even close, because the threats aren't just trying to, like, kick the door down anymore.
Right. They're trying to socially engineer you into handing over the key, or they're probing the foundational mathematics of the lock itself.
And in some cases, we're talking about entirely automated software agents operating at, you know, machine speed.
Yeah, it's wild. We are basically operating on an asymmetric battlefield. And the tools required to defend your sovereignty, they have to evolve just as fast, if not faster, than the vectors of attack.
They absolutely do.
So that is our mission with this deep dive. We want to cut through all the broader market noise and focus purely on what actually matters right now in Bitcoin self-custody based on the sources we're looking at this week.
We have a lot of ground to cover.
We really do. We're analyzing a massive wave of new hardware wallet architectures, AI agents spending sats natively on the Lightning Network, the very real dangers of phishing attacks, and a deep technical look at how developers are already preparing Bitcoin for a post-quantum world.
Because self-custody is a serious craft. Mm-hmm. It really is. It's not this one-time setup where you write down some words on paper and just forget about them.
Right.
It's an ongoing operational discipline. And the stack of sources we're looking at gives us a fascinating look at the tools being built to help us sharpen that craft, starting right at the physical layer.
Yeah, let's start there. Because to participate safely in the Bitcoin network, you need robust key generation and protection. And, well, we saw some major, really divergent strategies in how hardware manufacturers are approaching this recently.
Oh, absolutely. The divergence is the most interesting part.
Yeah. So Blockstream detailed their two-pronged approach with the new Jade devices. They've essentially split their product line to address two entirely different threat models.
Right, catering to completely different users.
Exactly. So first you have the Jade Core, which features a USB-C connection, Bluetooth, a color display, and like a five-minute setup.
Super accessible.
Very. But then you have the Jade Plus, which is built for the absolute verification maximalist. Like, it relies exclusively on air-gapped QR signing, a built-in camera, and an SD card. No wires.
Yeah, and despite those completely different user experiences, they actually share the exact same foundational security architecture.
Wait, really?
Yeah. Both the Jade Core and the Jade Plus run on the same open-source code base. And they both utilize what's called a blind oracle security model.
Okay, the blind oracle. That is a fascinating mechanism that we should probably unpack because it solves a huge problem with physical device theft.
It really does. Because historically, right, if someone stole your hardware wallet, they basically had unlimited time to try and brute force the PIN.
Right, or like physically extract the seed from the chips in a lab.
Exactly. But the blind oracle acts sort of like a two-key safety deposit box. The Jade device holds a heavily encrypted blob of your wallet data, but it doesn't actually hold the decryption key itself.
Okay, so where is the key?
A remote server, the Oracle, holds the key. So when you enter your PIN on the device, the Jade communicates blindly with the server to unlock the data.
Right, and because the server is the one enforcing the rules, it can strictly limit the PIN attempts.
Precisely. If an attacker physically steals your Jade and tries guessing your PIN, the remote oracle will permanently lock them out after three failed attempts.
Oh, wow.
Yeah. The beauty of this is that it allows users to have a simple, memorable PIN without sacrificing security to a local brute force attack.
That makes total sense. Blockstream is essentially acknowledging that the onboarding friction for a new user, you know, plugging in a USB-C cable, is totally different from the operational requirements of someone securing a massive stack via air-gapped QR codes.
Right. But neither user should have to compromise on that underlying cryptography.
Yeah. Now, Foundation's new Passport Prime takes a slightly different I'd say, a hardcore maximalist approach to that physical layer.
Very hardcore.
Right. Like, they aren't relying on a remote server at all. They are building, basically, a laser grid vault directly into the hardware with this active tamper system.
Yeah, the active tamper system is intense. It utilizes multiple internal physical tamper switches embedded right in the device, along with protective epoxy.
So what happens if someone tries to break into it?
Well, if the device detects any physical intrusion attempt, like if someone literally tries to pry the casing open with a tool, it instantly triggers a wipe of the secure element.
Just completely nukes it.
Instantly. Mm. By the time the attacker actually gets to the chips, the sensitive data is already gone.
That is incredible. And the sources also emphasize that the Passport crime runs on KeyOS, explicitly pointing out that it is not a general-purpose mobile operating system.
Which is a crucial distinction. Running a general-purpose OS, like Android, or even a heavily modified Linux build, introduces a massive attack surface.
Right, because there's just so much extra code.
Exactly. There are simply too many lines of code, too many background network processes, and just too many potential vulnerabilities that an attacker could exploit.
So they just stripped all that away.
Yeah, by utilizing a dedicated stripped-down architecture like KeyOS, Foundation ruthlessly minimizes that attack surface. It's a completely offline device. It only connects via their encrypted quantum link or through air-gapped QR codes.
You know, I look at this divergence in hardware, and it raises a really practical question for anyone holding their own keys. Well, we have these laser grid vaults like the Passport Prime or the Jade Plus, and then we have the solid deadbolt approach of the Jade Core with its Bluetooth convenience. I think the average user might wonder if the air-gapped complexity is actually necessary for them.
Yeah, and look, it ultimately depends on your personal threat model. But we must be clear about the technical reality here.
Right.
Offline, air-gap signing is the only security model that truly scales against remote attacks. Period.
So the moment a cable is involved.
The moment you introduce a physical connection to an internet-connected computer, even just a USB cable, you introduce risk.
Yeah.
The Jade Core's Bluetooth and USB-C are incredibly convenient for someone just starting out. And that blind Oracle does protect the keys wonderfully. But absolute sovereignty, that comes from a device where the keys never, ever touch a connected wire.
Right, where updates only happen via an SD card.
Exactly. Signing happens by scanning QR codes through a camera lens.
Yeah.
It's just you and your keys, entirely isolated from the internet.
So speaking of advanced isolation techniques, ColdCard's latest major firmware update, version 5.5.0, adds a really crucial layer for people managing physical backups.
Oh, the XOR split.
Yeah.
Yes.
Yeah, they've integrated support for generating QR codes of XOR split seeds. And for anyone unfamiliar, an XOR split is drastically different from just, you know, literally cutting your 24-word seed phrase in half on a piece of paper.
Drastically different and way safer.
Right, because if you cut your seed phrase in half and store 12 words in a safe and 12 words under your mattress, an attacker who finds one half only has to brute force the remaining 12 words.
Which is trivially easy for modern computers. They'd crack it in no time.
Exactly. So how does the XOR split actually work?
So the math behind XOR, which stands for exclusive OR, is a bitwise operation that mathematically scrambles the data.
Okay.
When you do an XOR split, you generate two entirely separate 24-word phrases. Neither phrase contains any part of the original secret on its own.
So they just look like random words.
Complete gibberish independently. You must combine both mathematically to reveal the true wallet. And ColdCard, allowing users to display these split pieces as QR codes, makes verifying and managing these complex geographically distributed backups much less prone to human transcription errors.
Which is huge, because humans make mistakes writing things down all the time. And ColdCard is also addressing the psychology of physical attacks with their trick pin feature.
The very necessary feature.
Because the cryptography might be flawless, right?
Yeah.
But if an attacker shows up at your door with a wrench and physically forces you to unlock your device, all the encryption in the world won't save you.
Right. The trick pin in mitigates that physical duress. It gives you a plausible compliance mechanism.
So you type in the fake PIN.
Exactly. If you were forced to type in a code, the trick PIN unlocks a completely different outcome. It could unlock a dummy wallet holding a small decoy amount of funds to satisfy the attacker.
Oh.
Or it could trigger a protocol that silently and permanently wipes the device entirely, making it look like a factory reset error.
Oh no, the device broke.
Yeah, that perfectly illustrates how hardware secures the human element. But what happens when the entity holding the keys isn't human at all.
This is where things get really crazy.
Yeah. Moving from the physical world into automated software, the sources highlight how the Lightning Network is undergoing this massive infrastructural shift to support artificial intelligence.
It's a profound paradigm shift.
Because AI agents require permissionless, programmatic money to function autonomously, right?
Yeah.
And the Lightning Network is basically becoming their native financial rail.
It has to be. Because traditional banking rails are entirely closed off to them. And AI cannot walk into a bank branch, show a driver's license, and open a checking account to pay for its own server costs.
Right. Obviously not.
Bitcoin, specifically via Lightning, is the only natively digital, mathematically enforced bearer asset that an AI can use to settle value instantly.
And we are seeing wallets lean into this heavily this week. Like Albi Hub's recent update, version 1.22.2, prominently features a dedicated AI and agents management system.
Yes, they've integrated core Lightning backend support, but the real engine driving this is a protocol called Nostr Wallet Connect. Or NWC.
And NWC is the breakthrough here. It's what makes this entire agentic economy viable while still maintaining user self-custody.
How so?
Well, normally, giving a third-party app access to your Lightning node requires handing over a macaroon.
A macaroon.
Yeah, it's a very powerful authentication token that basically gives the app full control to drain your funds. NWC completely changes that. It uses the Nostr protocol, which is a decentralized messaging network, to pass encrypted payment requests.
Okay, so instead of giving the AI the actual keys to the vault, you're using NWC to cryptographically restrict its budget.
Exactly. You can generate a specific NWC connection that explicitly tells your node, hey, allow this AI to spend a maximum of 100,000 sats per month and only for these specific types of invoices.
That's brilliant.
Yeah. The AI requests the payment via an encrypted Nostr message. Your node verifies that the request fits within the cryptographic budget you set, and then your node executes the payment. The AI never actually holds your keys.
And developers are building consumer-facing products around this architecture immediately. Like, we just saw the announcement of Agentic AQUA, which is a wallet environment explicitly designed to allow AI agents to have their own liquid and Bitcoin balances.
It's moving so fast.
Right. Like, your AI assistant can go out, negotiate a price for a virtual private server, spin up the server, pay the invoice, and generate research reports for you entirely without you having to click approve on anything.
And the infrastructure supporting this is rapidly maturing at the base layer too. We're seeing major Lightning implementations like CLN version 26.06 RC1 roll out Bolt-T12 payment proofs natively.
And Bolt-T12 is crucial for AI autonomy, right?
Absolutely. A traditional Lightning invoice, a Bolt-T11 invoice, is basically a single-use receipt. It expires, and if you want to pay someone again, they have to generate a brand new invoice.
Which requires them to be online and active.
Yep. Exactly. Bolt-T12 creates static, reusable payment offers. Mm-hmm. So an AI can have a permanent QR code or text string that can receive payments indefinitely without needing a server constantly awake to generate new invoices.
I do have to ask, though, like, is giving an AI a Lightning wallet basically handing a toddler a blank check? It feels risky.
That's a fair concern. And it brings up an infrastructural trade-off regarding who actually runs the node processing these AI payments.
Right, because there's Blockstream Green migrating from Breeze to Greenlight, and then there's Albigo.
Right. Running a dedicated hardware node in your house gives you absolute sovereignty, free from any third-party dependency. But services like Albigo introduce a cloud custody model.
So self-custody in the cloud.
Yeah, you hold your own keys securely, but the service provider manages the actual Lightning routing infrastructure in the cloud. It drastically reduces the maintenance overhead. You aren't managing channel liquidity or worrying about your Raspberry Pi overheating in your closet, but it introduces a single point of failure for uptime. If the cloud service goes down, your AI cannot process payments, even though your underlying funds remain perfectly safe.
It's a constant balancing act between operational convenience and absolute resilience. But, you know, having a laser grid hardware vault and programmatic Lightning nodes is completely meaningless if your operational security is compromised.
This is the hard truth.
The human is almost always the primary exploit. The threats are relentless, they're highly sophisticated, and they prey on our tendency to just, you know, take shortcuts.
Yeah, we saw a brutal active phishing alert circulate recently regarding a fake, malicious Envoy desktop app.
Oh, man.
Attackers were sending highly targeted emails to Bitcoiners, directing them to a cloned website to download a desktop management tool for their hardware.
And to be completely clear to everyone listening, no official Envoy desktop version exists.
None. Zero. Anyone who downloaded that file essentially installed malware designed specifically to scan their computer for wallet files and keystrokes to steal their stack.
That is terrifying. And it ties directly into broader cybersecurity data we're seeing on this credential crisis. Like, the Proton data highlighted that small to medium businesses are heavily targeted by ransomware, and the primary entry point in nearly 40% of incidents is human error and password reuse.
It's always password reuse. People use the same password for their email, their exchange account, and their password manager.
Which is just a recipe for disaster.
Especially when paired with SIM swap attacks. We have to emphasize this. Stop renting your security from a telecom company.
Say it louder.
Seriously. If your primary defense is SMS two-factor authentication, your net worth is protected by a minimum wage customer service representative at a phone company who can be socially engineered into porting your phone number to an attacker's SIM card.
Yep. And once they have your texts.
Once they have your texts, they reset your email password, and from there, they systematically dismantle your digital life. You must transition to offline two-factor authentication, like physical security keys, and isolate your self-custody operations entirely.
The catastrophic results of human error in complex cryptographic setups were fully on display with the recent $10.8 million drain on ThorChain, too.
Oh, that was a mess.
Yeah, and the broader cryptocurrency market loves to talk up TSS thresholds, signature schemes, and MPC multi-party computation. They pitch it as this modern alternative to multisig.
They do, but this massive hack exposed the fundamental fragility of that MPC architecture.
So for people who don't know, how does MPC actually differ from standard multisig?
In a traditional multi-party computation setup, a group of nodes collaborates to produce a single standard digital signature. The private key never exists in full in any one place. It is broken into cryptographic shards distributed among the participants.
Sounds secure in theory.
In theory, yes. The idea is that an attacker would have to compromise multiple nodes simultaneously. But the brutal reality of MPC is that the math is incredibly delicate.
Like a house of cards.
Exactly. In nearly every published attack on these systems, compromising just one vulnerable cosigner allows the attacker to manipulate the cryptographic communication and extract everyone else's shards.
Oh, wow.
Yeah, reconstructing the full master key entirely offline.
To visualize the difference, I like to think of MPC as taking a detailed treasure map and cutting it into five pieces, and you give one piece to each of your friends.
Right.
If an attacker is clever enough, they only need to steal one single piece of the map to algorithmically deduce the mathematical pattern and guess the rest of the map.
That's a great way to put it.
But true Bitcoin multisig is completely different. A 2-of-3 Bitcoin multisig setup is like having a physical vault door with three distinct locks. You give three separate keys to three separate friends.
And those keys never touch.
Exactly. To open the vault, two distinct keys must be turned in the lock simultaneously. They never interact, they never combine to form a master key. So if a thief steals one key, they are mathematically 0% closer to opening the vault.
And we have to remember, the threat model against MPC is accelerating rapidly because of AI. With large language models automatically scanning code bases for vulnerabilities, the barrier to compromising one of those MPC validator nodes is dropping fast.
It's scary.
It is. Bitcoin's native multisig relies on verifiable, independent key signatures. And we are actually seeing that multisig architecture become much more accessible, with Miniscript integration rolling out to consumer hardware devices, like the upcoming Trezor update.
Miniscript is an absolute game changer for multisig because it allows you to write programmable vault rules directly into the Bitcoin script in a way that software can easily verify.
Right. It's not just basic logic anymore.
Exactly. Instead of a simple require 2-of-3 keys, you can write an exact conditional rule you can mathematically dictate. Require 2-of-3 keys to spend today. But if one of the signers is lost and the funds haven't moved for 90 days, allow the transaction to clear with only one key.
Which is incredible. You are writing the recovery protocol mathematically into the blockchain before you ever need it. It removes the human panic from the equation during an emergency.
But, and this is a big but, executing these advanced scripts requires staying vigilant on the software side. Constantly see rapid patches pushed for critical Linux vulnerabilities, like the Umbrella OS 1.7.3 update dropping a patch for the Dirty Frag CVEs.
Yep, the vigilance never stops.
Self-custody is not a set-it-and-forget-it action. You should be running routine drills. Restore a wallet from a seed phrase on a wiped device. verify your receive addresses directly on the hardware screen, not just the computer monitor.
Exactly.
Because if your recovery process fails during a calm Sunday afternoon practice run, you can fix it.
Yeah.
But if you wait to test your backup until your node is compromised or your hardware dies, it's a total disaster.
A completely avoidable disaster.
Right. So we've covered physical wrench attacks, autonomous AI spending limits, and the human propensity to reuse passwords. But zooming out to the longest time horizon, we have to look at the existential threat to the cryptography itself.
The quantum threat.
Yes. Securing against today's hackers is one thing. Securing against tomorrow's quantum computers is entirely different. The sources this week dug into the concrete engineering happening right now for post-quantum Bitcoin.
And this is perhaps the most critical long-term engineering work happening in the entire industry.
Okay. Break it down for us. What's the actual danger here?
Well, the cryptographic foundation of Bitcoin relies heavily on discrete logarithm problems, specifically the Schnorr and ECDSA signatures we use today.
Right.
Large-scale quantum computers running Schnorr's algorithm will eventually be able to solve these problems trivially, meaning they could derive your private key directly from your public key.
Which obviously breaks the whole system.
Completely.
So Blockstream Research published a massive proposal to address this exact threat. OP check Shrin Shrins. It's a hash-based signature opcode for post-quantum Bitcoin. But to appreciate the solution, we kind of have to understand why this is such a difficult problem to begin with. Like, why can't we simply swap out our current signatures for the standard post-quantum schemes that government agencies are currently standardizing?
Because of the catastrophic throughput collapse.
Throughput collapse.
Yeah.
If we were to adopt standard post-quantum candidates, like the heavily vetted SLH-DSA algorithm, it would completely choke the Bitcoin network.
How bad are we talking?
These algorithms produce massive signatures. We're talking around 8 kilobytes of data per transaction.
Oh, wow.
For context, if we forced 8 kilobyte signatures onto the base layer today, network throughput would plummet to a mere 0.36 transactions per second.
0.36, that's barely a third of a transaction per second.
Exactly. The blockchain would bloat uncontrollably. It completely breaks the network's ability to clear normal, everyday traffic.
Okay, so that's obviously a non-starter. So how does this SHA-NCS proposal actually solve the data bloat?
It's really clever. It changes the fundamental dimension of the signature scheme from stateless to stateful.
Okay, explain that.
Think of every hash-based signature scheme essentially like a tear-off calendar. You have a signature budget, meaning a set number of times a key can be used to sign a message securely.
Right.
Standard algorithms like SLH-DSA have an astronomically high budget, too, to the power of 64. That allows you to sign things endlessly without ever worrying about it, but it requires massive cryptographic proofs to secure.
Hence the 8 kilobytes.
Exactly. What SHA-NCS does is drastically lower that budget. By shrinking the number of times a key can sign and keeping a strict persistent counter of exactly which page of the calendar you are on, they can compress the signature size from 8 kilobytes down to just 580 bytes.
Wow, that's a massive reduction. And compressing it to 580 bytes brings the throughput back up to a vastly more sustainable 3 transactions per second on the compact path, right?
Nice, much more sustainable. Right.
But understanding that tear-off calendar analogy reveals a massive practical danger for everyday users.
I know exactly where you're going with that.
Right, because if the signature scheme is stateful, meaning it relies on a strict counter of how many times I've signed something, what happens if I accidentally restore an old wallet backup file on my desktop? Doesn't that roll the counter back to a page I've already torn off?
It does. And that is a fantastic question, because that exact fragility is what makes stateful signatures incredibly dangerous in a pure software environment.
So it would just expose the keys?
Yes. If you roll back the state and reuse a hash that has already been published on the blockchain, you expose the underlying private key structure, and an attacker can steal your funds.
Ooh.
Which is precisely why the SHA-NCS proposal relies exclusively on dedicated hardware signing devices.
Oh, so the hardware manages the state internally, locking that counter away from the user completely.
Exactly. On initialization, the hardware device generates the seed and sets the counter state. That state lives exclusively on the secure element. When you sign a transaction, the hardware ticks the counter forward, and that counter can never, ever go backward. It entirely removes the human's ability to accidentally corrupt the state by restoring an outdated software backup file.
Okay, but hardware breaks. Hardware gets lost in boating accidents. If the user loses the physical device containing that strictly enforced state counter, how do they recover their funds without corrupting the state?
And that is where the fallback mechanism called shrimps comes in.
Shrimps?
Yeah, shrimps. If your hardware is destroyed and you have to load your seed into a brand new backup device, that new device has no idea what the previous counter state was, right?
Right.
So it automatically falls back to a stateless path. The resulting signature for that recovery transaction becomes much larger, about 3,000 bytes.
So it's more expensive to mine.
It is. But it mathematically guarantees you can always sweep your funds to a fresh wallet without risking state corruption.
Yeah.
It's a brilliant, pragmatic trade-off between everyday efficiency and disaster recovery. And they are already running it in C++ implementations to test it right now.
Wow. Seeing that level of deep architectural engineering happening in real time to secure the future of the network, it's just remarkable.
It really is.
So to synthesize all of this from our deep dive today, the tools of individual sovereignty are becoming highly specialized and incredibly powerful. We have physical hardware diverging into ultra-secure, air-gapped vaults to protect against wrench attacks and highly accessible devices for daily use.
Mm-hmm.
We have the Lightning Network rapidly maturing via Nostrawallet Connect and Bolt T12 to serve as the native programmable financial rail for autonomous AI agents.
Yep.
And most importantly, we are seeing that true security, whether it's managing complex multi-sig quorums, stopping phishing attacks, or navigating post-quantum signature states, requires active, informed participation from you, the user.
Absolutely. You simply cannot outsource your sovereignty and expect to retain your security. The technology provides the cryptographic enforcement, from Miniscript vaults to Sejar NCS opcodes, but the weakest link will always be operational discipline.
Right. We started by talking about the clear, comforting boundaries of a physical bank vault compared to the murky, asymmetric battlefield of digital self-custody. But I want to leave you with a final thought to mull over as we close out this deep dive into this source material.
Let's hear it.
If autonomous AI agents are already using Nostrawallet Connect to spend sats independently today, managing their own budgets and server costs, how long until we see those same AI agents acting as automated cosigners in our own personal multi-sig quorums?
Oh, I know.
Imagine a vault where an AI cosigner mathematically enforces your spending rules, verifying your biometric identity and the contextual logic of the transaction in real time, completely immune to human bias or physical duress.
That's entirely possible.
The deadbolt of the future might not just be a piece of hardware or a mathematical equation. It might be an intelligence. Think about that as you review your own security protocols. Until next time, stay safe out there.